welcome to Better Being Me. I am your host, Joanne Hatchard. Better Being Me is all about celebrating the neurodivergent woman, learning how to be safe and secure enough to drop the masking, embracing the true version of who you are. My goal is to share my stories and those of other neurodivergent people that prove we are not alone in our difficulties. And together we can be celebrating how we have overcome our challenges and fully embrace our life. I want to promote our unique perspective of the world. Hello, Leah. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining me on my podcast today. Leah, we were just reminiscing back in 2018 at an Ongaparinga Disability Expo Market thing. And I remember you so full of energy, bouncing up to me, so excited because we both had bees on our logo. So your Bumblebee Yoga, and I was Better Being Me. And my logo at the time, instead of the brains, had a little bee at the bottom of it. And it was like you were just dying to find some connection, that and that was enough. And you info jumped all over me. I was loving every second of it because it was a pretty quiet day. So it was nice to have a little bit of energy thrown my way. And since then, you've just been going from strength to strength, expanding your yoga. And this year started studying psych. Is that right?
I started my clinical PhD. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Fancy pants. I like it. Sorry, that was a bit excited.
I love it. No, I love the excitement.
Tell me more about this. Well, anyway, so hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Thanks for being here. Tell me more about this PhD, the clinical PhD. More.
Yeah, well, this was kind of always a plan. So I did my undergrad and kind of finished in like 2017. I did my honours and they were super burnt out. So I went and travelled for a little bit, went and worked, and then I was going to travel some more, and then COVID happened. And actually right before COVID happened was when I started the business, which was great timing. I must have met you later than 2018 because I don't think I had the business until 2019.
Oh.
But anyway, it was around that era. Just this year have come back to do my clinical PhD. So I'm a provisional psychologist, which is exciting and scary. And my research is on self-compassion and pro-social behavior. So very social psych. I have actually been at a conference this past week, so I'm a little bit like overwhelmed, brain dead. Like I've only just looked at the data from my first study, which is really exciting. But also in the past, year a bit. So I think it was late last year that I got diagnosed with ADHD. So it's been a whole new world, like studying with this new, knowing this new thing about myself, and then also really diving into neurodiversity affirming frameworks and stuff like that, which is something that I'd never really been exposed to before. So it's been a whole journey this past year.
That's amazing. So I'm so excited to have more neurodivergent people in the research community. Amazing. And then being that's a word I can't say. You're right. Provisional psychology. Oh, wow. Psychologist.
Yeah.
An amazing feat in itself. But to know that you've probably gone through all of those processes and only just having your ADHD diagnosis last year, how was all those study periods before? Where was it like a cycle of intense interest burnout?
Yeah, a little bit. And I think I got that a lot, like especially going through, like when I first was like, oh, I think I might have ADHD, a lot of people were like, oh no, but like you did really well at uni, so you can't have it. But the thing is, I was studying something I really loved. Like psychology is my like special interest. Like, Of course I did well in things that I really wanted to do. But definitely when a psychiatrist was asking me about like how I do assignments and stuff like that, I tend to fall into a cycle of I actually start assignments pretty early usually, but then trick myself into thinking that I've done more of them than I have. So I have the idea bit, because the idea bit's the fun bit, yeah. Where you like create your argument and you know the answer to the question. And I found this is a pattern recently as well, where you've got the answer to the question, then you're like, okay, well, I'm bored now. Like, I don't want to do the writing up bit. Like, I know what the answer is. Just take my word for it. I don't want to write the whole essay. And then would leave the actual writing to the last minute and had like realized that I had way more to do than I first thought I would have to. And then have many late nights crying, being like, why didn't I do this earlier? So it's been that whole process. But it's interesting, I had a discussion with my mum recently. It was really sweet. And she was like, do you resent us as parents for not picking up this sooner? And I was like, mum, no, I really don't. And I was kind of thinking about my childhood and now. And this is, okay, I've got a lot of like radical ideas about neurodiversity and how it's framed a very deficit space. But when I was a kid, I really had more of the strength side of my neurodivergencies than the deficits. I was really, really well supported. My parents and teachers, I was also very high masking. So like, I just came off as a kid who was like a little bit chaotic, but like went too far into my work rather than not doing enough of it. So I was really successful. And I got all the benefits of being creative and fun and high energy without really having the deficits of it. And it wasn't until I was an adult living on my own. And even like during COVID, like I had moved back from overseas. So I was living with my parents. And I was going to move out, and then COVID happened. I was like, I might just stay here for a little bit. So again, like I had gone from living with my parents to living with a partner to living overseas to living back with my parents. So I hadn't really lived like by myself before. So now I moved in here, like I've got housemates, but I'm like responsible for myself. And it wasn't until then, and when I was working full time and trying to take care of myself, that I'm like, oh, okay, like I'm actually really struggling with some of these things. And that's kind of when I realized the diagnosis and all that sort of stuff. And now going through that again, I'm like, exploring my autistic traits, let's put it that way. It's like a domino effect.
What's one without the other?
Pretty much. Statistically, I think you're actually more likely to have both than you are to have just one of them. So
yeah, the co-occurrence of Jesus. There is more likelihood to have a co-occurring condition rather than just one or the other. It's interesting you say that it wasn't until you kind of lived independently as such that you realized where the deficits were. I was exactly the same. My mum, unbeknownst to me, really put my life together. And it wasn't until we weren't living together anymore, I discovered how much of a shit shovel I was. Like, I was really shit at a lot of things.
Yeah, and you don't realize.
No idea. I thought I was pretty damn brilliant at a lot of things, which I also am. But didn't actually recognize that I was pretty crap at stuff and felt kind of shit about that for a long time. And now I'm allowed to be shit at stuff. That's my that's my song. You're allowed to be shit
exactly,
at stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. And the other thing that happens is that I've talked to a lot of other neurodivergent, a lot of people since I got my diagnosis have since gotten theirs. And I'm like, oh, this tracks that we all have it. But what definitely happens is that because it's got such a strong hereditary component, you grow up in families and you attract friend groups who are all neurodivergent. So then you never realize that what you're going through isn't normal. So I remember having conversations with my dad being like, yeah, but like, I really struggle with this thing. And I do this and like, I start a project and then I put it down and he's like, yeah, I do that. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe it's normal. And then after doing more, and I'm like, oh, no, it's just that all of us are just neurodivergent. And that makes sense. And then like, it's been interesting hanging out with family since then and being like, oh, it just keeps going. Like with my extended family, I'm like, okay, this makes sense. This tracks.
This is making sense to me now.
Yeah.
I vaguely touched on the idea that my dad might be ADHD because he likes to get to a place, be there for the allocated time and then go. And that allocated time is dependent on what his tasks are while he's there. If he doesn't have any tasks while he's there, then he's quite agitated. He needs to have a purpose to be there. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, I'm a bit like that as well. People, like, I'm always like running like either late or like just on time. And part of that is because I have really shitty like time perception. Like I think that I can fit a lot more into time than I actually can. Time moves faster than I think it does. But the other thing is I don't like being early, because then you get there early and you're just like sitting there and it's like not enough time to do something. And I get really like irritated sitting there not doing anything. That definitely plays into it. Yeah. As well, which is funny.
You see, I don't know what your signal for I'm done now is, but he stands up and goes, right. And that's him. Like, okay, then bye, Dad.
Yeah, we do that. But we also have this thing in my family called the Smolarek goodbye, where we say we're going to go and then we talk for another hour and we just progressively move closer to the door. So that's also so frustrating when one person is like overstimulated and wants to go home. Happens with my dog. My dog's like, as soon as we put the leash on, he's like, oh, so we're going. And then we talk for another half an hour and he's like, Mom, I just want to go home. I'm like, sorry.
Let me leave. Yes. My dad doesn't do that, not surprisingly, but my aunt manages and my mom manages to create new conversations as I was and I'm like looking at the door and then I'm looking at them going, I'm not entirely sure why we couldn't do this before.
Yeah.
I'm ready now.
It's just a weird social thing that happens.
I've already given you my hugs. That is it. You get no more.
Fair.
So tell me more about these conferences, because this is the second one that I've seen you on in like at least 6 months.
Yeah, I'm actually really fortunate. Like going to conferences in the first year of your PhD is not always like something that gets to happen. But the last one I went to was more of a symposium that was held at the University of Queensland. And I actually met a bunch of really cool neurodivergent people. Just like the conference was about compassion. But just by chance, there was like a good like 3 or 4 sessions on neurodivergency, and I met a wonderful psychologist called Monique Mitchelson, who also has a podcast about ADHD and neurodiversity and autism and all the things. So we connected and had a really good time. And there was one point around lunch where we're all standing around and we all looked around and we're like, oh, it's all the neurodivergent people talking to each other. So that was really cool, being able to present there. I hadn't even done any actual research at that stage. I didn't have any data, but they were super welcoming and all that sort of stuff. This was the first conference that I went to. It was hosted by Flinders, but it's a big social psychology conference. There's like 250 people there or something like that, and got to present some research, which was kind of cool. But in true ADHD fashion, tried to fit way too much in my presentation, talked way too quick, and one of my supervisors was watching and she was like, I thought I did really well. And I came off and she's like, so we've got some work to do. You've got great potential to be a good speaker. And I was like, ow. I know she meant that in the best way possible. She gave me really, really helpful feedback, but my rejection sensitivity was just like, I did bad. But it's okay. We've moved past it. I'm meeting with my other supervisor today and we're going to go over some stuff. And I'm on placement next semester. So it's about to get real busy because I'm going to have coursework and placement and thesis work. So it's all kind of happening next semester. So I'm having to kind of juggle business stuff and PhD stuff and just general life stuff as well.
Wow. That is a hefty schedule. You obviously do more than one thing a day.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because when I was first looking at the diagnosis, I'm like, a lot of people just said to me, I think you've just got a lot on your plate. And that's why you have like, you forget things and why you feel like you're chaotic and disorganized. So for a long time, I just held that and I was like, oh, I just have too much on my plate. I thought it was kind of rooted in perfectionism and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, but why do I have a lot of things on my plate? It's because of the ADHD. Like it's because I can't sit still and I'm like, I try to take too much on at once and I'm just like dopamine mining all the time. But I've had some really interesting insights recently about like the relationship between ADHD and, or just neurodiversity in general and perfectionism, and the way that we kind of mask and try to like use perfectionism to kind of counteract some of the other like social, again, I don't like using deficits, but like you're trying so hard to fit into the neurotypicals that perfectionism and doing things and achieving things is like a way that you get positive attention. And the way that you kind of fit in if you do things well or if you know things. So then that kind of manifests and like just snowballs into other things. And I think without that knowledge of neurodivergence within yourself, like without having that diagnosis and being able to unpack that, like that's a major missing part of the way, like learning how you work. So this is kind of what I try to explain to people, that like it's not just about like, oh, you're like neurodivergent.
Bentley. Such a cute puppy too.
Come here. Do you want to come say hi? Come here. Come say hi. Oh no, he's he's having a tantrum. Let's close the window. Whenever I'm having meetings, this is the time he decides to bark. So I think like being able to have that knowledge about yourself is so important, and things that like are unfortunately not accessible to a lot of people. And because it is so deficit based, the way that it gets talked about, it's more about like fixing symptoms rather than being able to practice self-compassion. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That perfectionism. I'm also dyslexic, so I've spoken about this before. Like I've gotten used to the fact that I'm not going to get it right. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm really tired, that leaks into everything. And then it turns into slapdash, whatever. I can't do it right anyway. Mm-hmm. But I was just thinking the other day, because I like keep saying I don't have perfectionism, but I do remember so I knit. But I remember undoing a beret about 10 times. Because I hadn't got it right, but I kept on going. I hadn't got it right. So I undo it. And I'm like, in the end, I stopped doing it because I wasn't going to get it right. But reality being, if I was down a couple of stitches, it wouldn't have made any difference. And that differentiating between letting it go because it's not really going to make a difference, but keep going. Mm. And I'm not going to get this right. So I'm going to dump it like a hot mess and leave it and feel like shit for myself, you know? Mm-hmm. So it is. There is that compassion on letting it go and letting it be okay, mm-hmm. to then keep on going. Crocheting is much more forgiving because you can fudge that a little bit better. But yeah, it's that letting it be okay that it is wrong.
Mm.
I think there's that, yeah, that there's a fine balance in getting that right and letting go of that perfectionism, because yeah, we do tie in accolades from getting things great.
Mm,
and it's really hard to dismantle that. And that's what's been happening. The praise has come when you get things right from such a young age, you know. It's not the effort that we're praising, it's the result.
Mm, exactly. And I remember I had a big breakthrough about this recently. And the other way that self-compassion comes in as well is having compassion for that version of yourself who so desperately wanted to connect to people and so desperately wanted to be loved that she was willing to do everything in her power to make other people happy and to people please and to just try so hard to get things right and not understand why. Like I had a bunch of friendships growing up that just combusted and I never understood why. So that left me with a lot of like issues around like friendships and relationships because I didn't understand why they had fallen apart. But then it sometimes backfires as well because I somewhere along the line learned that like providing value to people, providing information to people was how you got them to like you or how you were good to other people, how you pleased other people. But sometimes how that manifests is like accidentally giving unsolicited advice. And because you're trying to be useful and you're trying to be valuable to people. And then realizing later on that that was not the socially appropriate thing to do. And you're actually just info dumping on someone when they actually just need you to be like, damn, that sucks. Instead of being like, let me tell you everything I know about how to solve this problem. So again, like having compassion for that part of yourself that really wanted to help and like acknowledging the intention behind it and all that sort of stuff and acknowledging that it's part of your beautiful, big, wonderful brain that sometimes misses the mark a little bit.
I feel like you've just highlighted about 10 years of my career. I would praise myself in maybe not being the subject matter expert, but at least knowing where the information was. I was the data miner. So I don't know the information, but I know who does know the information. And one of my habits that I've redirected is exactly what you've said, providing that unsolicited advice on whatever research I've been having at the time and what the best way to go forward, blah, 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 blah. I've had to redirect that until I have to wait until people actually ask me for help.
Mm-hmm.
And that draws the line in the sand. And then once they ask me, there is the info dump. But mm-hmm. if they just want to, you know, get stuff off their chest and not actually have that thing, they generally don't ask for help. They just want to info dump on you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's how I've delineated between now they want my input and now they don't want my input. If there's a direct asking for help, then I am all in.
Yeah, exactly. And once you know that about yourself is really important, because there are kind of two ways. Like, once you know that about yourself, one tendency is to start beating yourself up about it and being like, oh my God, like, why am I so awkward? Why can't I get this right? Like, oh my God, people must hate me. Versus, okay, I know this about myself. And also something I've been unpacking recently is masking and authenticity and how to manage that while still being a good friend. So I did a lot of work around values in terms of things like interrupting people or speaking out a lot in class. Like, I ask a lot of questions in class, which I feel like other people might find annoying, despite the fact that people have told me many, many times that it's not annoying and then usually good questions. But I feel really insecure about asking questions. And but I try not to dominate the conversation. So I kind of pull it back to my values of like wanting to be a good classmate, wanting to be a good friend. So I'm not masking. I'm not trying to make myself smaller in order to make other people more comfortable, because that's masking and that's not good for my well-being. But living according to my values of being a good friend and being a good classmate and whatever is authentic for me. So it's kind of that balance between like wanting to behave in a way socially that is good for everyone around me versus just trying to make myself small to make other people more comfortable, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. And I think that that's a big conversation to start having, because there is a lot of pushing to drop the mask, but then there's no support behind what happens when you drop the mask. Like the masking has been there for such a long time, it is generally a security measure, so that when we're asking you to drop the masking, there needs to be the backup of this is what that actually looks like. And I think you've highlighted that you can, if you're living by values, then that is how you determine and make decisions on those values. I think that's amazing. There's a big amount of like, it's kind of like there's only so much information you can set through on social media, and the stop points generally, let's drop masking, but it's not, let's create your values. Let's see how you're going to be making decisions, because anybody with weak executive functioning has difficulty making decisions, especially when they're stressed. That's one of the first capacities that goes, is that ability to make decisions. So if we've got this cornerstone of what our values are, then it's really simple, because they may fluctuate in intensity, but they generally don't change. So yeah, maybe there's a lot of work around creating the values. I know I did it when I read the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That's one of their big things, is to create your core values.
And it's
amazingly.
Exactly. And that's the center of a lot of like I'm a big fan of acceptance commitment therapy, which that's one of the core parts of it as well. But I do think this masking thing is a really nuanced conversation that often gets missed. It's not like you either mask or you don't mask. Like, we're all actively constructing, even neurotypical people are actively constructing the person that they want to be. And also, like, masking does serve a purpose. And just dropping the mask altogether, like, being neurodivergent doesn't like preclude you from being an asshole. Like, you can still be a dick and like, you know what I mean? So a lot of people are like, oh, I can just drop the mask and say whatever I want to say regardless of other people's feelings. Like, that's not the take that we want to, you know, take from this. And same as like masking can, like, it is safety, and I kind of parallel a little bit to queerness and being out. Like, it is still like you're coming out as something. Like, in some situations, sadly, like, it's not safe to be out, which is horrible. And that's a society problem. And it is the same with neurodivergence as well. Like, it's a society problem, but like masking is sometimes less exhausting than being yourself, because you still have to construct the situation around you. You have to decide how much energy, like, it can take a lot of energy to be perceived as your true self.
Yeah.
And that can sometimes be more than masking, like more effort than masking as well. Yeah. And I think that's the nuance of the conversation that's being missed a little bit. And yes, it is a society issue, but also, yeah, we need to make sure that neurodivergent people don't feel like they're being inauthentic for masking in some situations. But then we need to also be able to create spaces where unmasking and having space to create the kind of person that you want to be is celebrated and accepted. And all that sort of stuff, which is very much the direction of like clinical work that I'd like to go in as well.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And it's interesting, like you were saying in the symposium, that the people that were gathering together were the neurodivergent people. And yeah. I guess that is the way of creating that safe space, because mm-hmm. I would guarantee that nobody was masking while they were in that specific group. Mm-hmm. But when they turn around, they may have to put their professional face back on, right?
Yeah, exactly. And finding it's funny, I say finding neurodivergent community. Turns out it was around me the whole time. None of us knew. So yeah, like looking at all my friends around me, and I've realized that, yeah, like almost all the people I get along with straight away. And this is also where I'm like exploring my autistic traits as well, because I'm like, oh no, like I don't have, you know, I've got really good social skills and I have good friends and all that sort of stuff. And I look around, I'm like, oh, these are all neurodivergent friends though, almost entirely. When I'm really good friends with a neurotypical person, I almost get a little bit suspicious. I'm like, either you're about to find out something about yourself, or this is just a weird exception to the rule that I get along with you really well. Yeah, which is just interesting. And it is like, I found it really, really helpful to find community. And it's, again, it's the same with queerness, like finding community around you where you feel like you can be yourself, finding neurodivergent people around you where you can like compare notes and be like, oh, it's not just me. Like and that's also a core element of self-compassion as well. And obviously self-compassion, neurodivergence is a very big passion of mine. But common humanity is one of the core components of self-compassion, where you acknowledge and understand that like suffering and your difficulties is what brings you together the most. And finding community is definitely a way to also be able to cultivate self-compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the the common themes throughout my clients is that they really do feel isolated until they recognize that isolation isn't a symptom of being neurodivergent, but it's a byproduct of not having the community. Mm. And another byproduct of that is having that internal monologue that we don't talk about. Mm-hmm. Because we haven't had the community that recognizes and agrees and goes, oh yeah, that's me too, kind of thing. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is to start expressing that inner monologue, because the more they do, the more that they will find that they are not alone and they can drop that isolation feeling. But mm-hmm. it is a pattern of behavior from not being in a society that's accepting of how you think or what you think, that you start to just keep it to yourself.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think that's why social media is another conversation that doesn't have enough nuance to it, because there's this whole like rhetoric about people who like just go on TikTok and diagnose themselves with autism or ADHD or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, that's kind of how I found out about my neurodivergence as well. And I don't think that takes anything away from it, but like for the first time I was able to see other people's stories. Like, how else am I meant to find out about that, you know, and for the first time I had direct access to people with lived experience. And I'm like, oh, this makes sense. And there was a study that came out recently talking about like misinformation on TikTok, especially to do with ADHD diagnoses. And they were saying that a very high percentage of the information on TikTok is misinformation, but they miss the nuance. I'm pretty sure the authors were neurotypical. Don't quote me on that, but like I just got the vibe, you know, because a lot of things that get talked about, say for example, object permanence. A lot of people are like, oh, ADHD means you have no object permanence. That in a technical sense isn't true. Like object permanence is something you talk about with like babies and children, where they don't know that something exists once it leaves their field of vision. A lot of animals, you know, you hide something, they don't know where it is. When people are talking about object permanence with ADHD, what we're really talking about is working memory. and forgetting that something is there once it's there. You still have the conceptual understanding that something is there when you can't see it. So it's not strictly object permanence. But if you say that that's misinformation, is actually just people describing their experience and not using the correct terminology. And you miss all this nuance, especially when it comes to women and people socialized as women, and it presents so differently. Both autism and ADHD present really differently in women and in adults as well. So I could talk a long time about all the issues with that we have with the DSM. But obviously we know that the DSM criteria is mostly based on young white boys. So adult women, people of color, gender diverse people, like all our experiences aren't really captured in the DSM. And there's also this might be a bit of a hot take, but there's a kind of myth that ADHD women or ADHD, yeah, women in general or girls are more likely to present as inattentive rather than hyperactive. That is kind of true in a sense, but is over like generalized to say that hyperactivity isn't in girls, where in actual fact it presents quite differently. Hyperactivity in girls is often like chattiness, my thoughts racing a million miles an hour, like that's still hyperactivity. And because we're socialized to be so compliant and obedient, I'm less likely to get up out of my chair, but I'm going to be fidgeting, I'm going to be distracted, I'm going to be like thinking about everything else other than what I'm meant to be doing because I don't want to be sitting still being restless.
Yeah.
So like there's all this nuance that isn't being captured and it's all very deficit based, all that sort of stuff. I have thoughts.
Indeed you do. Well, in that regard, do you have plans on going into the diagnosis area?
Yeah, definitely. I think I like definitely post PhD, I'd love to work in self-compassion and adult neurodivergence and neurodiversity affirming paradigms and stuff like that, because unfortunately a lot of, well, there's some good resources coming out for sure that are like written by neurodivergent people for neurodivergent people, but it's still very much lacking. And I think self-compassion in general is kind of misunderstood a little bit as well, as just like, oh, just be nice to yourself, when there's like a lot more complexity to it that isn't really captured. So I can see myself going into that. Whether or not I go into diagnosis specifically, I don't know. I think I am more comfortable in kind of like an education and advocacy kind of role when it comes to that, mostly because doing assessments is like kind of boring, like from a paperwork point of view. No, but I definitely can see myself in like kind of in that space a little bit as well, because it's so important and just the nuances miss. And actually, I'm really frustrated that in the clinical training so far, we did not cover adult neurodivergence at all. We got one lecture in child psych. We got an hour and a half on autism and an hour and a half on ADHD. That was it. We did actually have a little bit, like the person who took our personality disorder lecture in our like clinical, like diagnosis topic basically, was really good. She's neurodivergent and was talking about how personality disorders and neurodivergencies are often conflated or misdiagnosed, especially things like autism and BPD. So we did have a little bit of discussion about that, but really lacking a lot of like substance, especially when it comes to like autistic burnout and depression are treated completely differently. If you try to treat autistic burnout like you treat depression, you're going to make it worse. And every time I've said that to some, like said, had this conversation with someone in my class, they're like, oh, like I never would have known that. And I'm like, oh, like 20% of the population is neurodivergent. Like, why aren't we kind of like,
yeah, how is that not reflected in the studies right now?
Exactly. So,
well, I guess that leads into the fact that it's actually not reflected in the research either. It wouldn't be 20% of neurodivergent researchers that aren't looking for a damn cure.
Yeah.
So much time and energy is wasted on trying to find a cure for neurodivergence. It's obvious that they're not neurodivergent researchers.
Definitely. I know there's some big, very big name researchers that have got a lot of controversy. Even at the moment, there's a big genetic study going on that has a bit of controversy behind it as well. And there's actually, I mean, the thing is, I can kind of see things changing a little bit as well, which is good. Like we've got one researcher that I know of who used to be a lot in the ABA space, and I believe is moving out of that space because of lived experience voices, from what I know, but also people changing the way they talk about it. I can see it slowly shifting, but it is still frustrating. Even in other ways, like I unfortunately had a really bad experience with an employer where I disclosed, this was before my diagnosis, I think, but I disclosed that I was having trouble with these things and it came back to bite me in a job interview. And I didn't get the job because I had mentioned that I was having trouble with some things, which kind of just like put a sour taste in my mouth of being like, well, if I'm open about this, like, is it going to be bad for my career? And thankfully, like in academia, so much of academia is neurodivergent. And I think it was Chloe Hayden that was talking the other day. She was saying like, if you look at the top of any field, you're going to find neurodivergent people there. And I was looking around the conference this past week and I was like, that tracks. Because you get to spend all your time like researching about your special interests. Like, well, of course, right. You're going to find people up there.
You get to categorize data. Like, what is not to love?
Exactly.
And then join the dots and make conclusions. It's like data farming. I love data farming.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because you see, like, one of my supervisors is very much like on the ADHD side of things and is like very high energy, loves like creating new ideas and all that sort of stuff. And my other supervisor is very like particular detail oriented, will drill down on an idea. And I find it interesting the way that they play off of each other and the way that different members of the lab play off of each other. And like, we like compensate for each other's strengths and weaknesses in different ways. And it's beautiful to watch. I am really enjoying being in this space that's really flexible as well. Like working in a 9-to-5 job, I had a job last year where I got told off for like checking my phone and like being 2 minutes late to work despite having stayed back the night before, like all this other weird toxic stuff that was going on. Compare that to being a PhD student where you have all the flexibility in the world. The payoff is that you have to be quite disciplined in terms of like making sure you get your work done. But I'm here at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday, like able to do this, able to work on my business. Yesterday I took a day off. Oh my God, it was amazing. Spent the whole day like doing proper self-care things. You can't do that when you have a job. The payoff as well is that I only get paid like an average of $12 an hour or something like that on my scholarship, but we make it work.
Yes, if anything, the neurodivergent populace is very creative.
Exactly.
Resource management, creative, yes. I don't know about my mum used to call me MacGyver because I'd make something out of nothing. Which translates into the kitchens a lot of the time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Neurodivergent strengths and
I was just thinking the other day about that, working in a team and filling in the weaknesses with your strengths or vice versa. And it plays beautifully in nail salons. I don't know if you've got your nails done lately, but I got mine done. Yay. Thank you. And I was sitting there and I've got no idea what they were talking about. But it was just like a working in a beehive, like more people, because I was just a walk-in. I hadn't booked anything. And they kind of just took off where the other one started and then moved around, and I have no idea what they're doing, but they got everybody's nails done on time and there wasn't any big blow-ups or anything. It was just like a silent just movement of filling in the gaps, basically. And it's lovely when a team works that way, but you need to understand where your strengths and weaknesses are for that to happen, right? You don't want to be stubborn and saying, no, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, and then fall flat on your face. It's easier to say, I can't do it, but well, maybe I could do it, but I just need help. Like, that asking for help is a big, big step, I reckon, around the compassion, is that ability to ask for help and show that there is weakness.
Yeah. And exactly. And before you even get to that point, you need to be able to acknowledge that you don't have to be good at everything, and that actually, like, you can just have your strengths and be good at those things. Yeah. And I say a lot to people, like, the biggest thing hands down that I've gotten from a diagnosis is the ability to be more self-compassionate, as well as obviously researching self-compassion for a living. But like, the having a label and having words to describe it is really good. And knowing that, yeah, like, I don't have to be good at everything. And I think I grew up thinking that I was like bad at being neurotypical when I was actually just really good at being neurodivergent, and I didn't know that.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, what's that, like, you know, the saying about like if measuring a fish's intelligence by its ability to climb a tree or whatever. Yeah. You know, if you have got a different goal post, and yeah, like just leaning into the things that you're good at, like why would you just like keep beating whatever that saying is, like why would you keep doing something that you're not good at or not enjoying? That's the other thing, I would do things that I didn't enjoy because I thought I should be good at them. When I'm like, actually I just want to do these things that I'm good at and hand off everything else. And actually that's what I plan to do in my business as well. I really have been trying to hand off a lot of my admin work, but then all my plans so far to do that have fallen through, so I'm still lumped with all of my admin work, and I'm like, I don't want to write invoices for the rest of my life. But I love being like, my dream setup is like being able to be the creative director of the business where I get to do all the fun stuff and having everybody else do the details, pick up after me. One day, that's the goal.
One day, well, they just need to find the people where the details are their thumb zone, right?
Yeah, exactly. I need to find an autistic person who really loves doing the detail stuff. And I can just let my crazy brain go for it.
I know, and that it's one of the sayings that aggravates me so highly is when they say things like you know, Beyonce has the same 24 hours as you. I'm like, well, that may be true, sure, but she also got a buttload of assistants just cleaning up whatever mess she's created behind her, clearing the path ahead of her, so she just has to walk in a straight line looking fabulous. And I've no doubt not done her own hair, not done her own makeup, and not picked her own clothes. Like, yeah, there's the same 24 hour, but if I had that same amount of support around, then maybe I could be also the bay of the social worker.
Exactly. And that's so problematic when it comes to, especially I had this discussion the other day about like diet culture, which is another whole thing I won't get into, but I could get into it, about being like, oh, I'll do the celebrities workout thing so I can look like them. And I'm like, babe, that's not gonna work. It just sets up all these unrealistic expectations, and everyone's prone to that, like no matter your neurotype. But it definitely, I think, happens with neurodivergent people where you're like, oh, I should be able to do this thing, why can't I do it? And it's actually just like a normal thing to be able to struggle with.
Yeah, nobody wants to drink cabbage water for the rest of their life, like it's just not a thing.
Yeah, also it's not worth it.
No, totally not worth it. I guess that ties into the social naivety that is common within the neurodivergent community. And that tie, like bringing in that wanting to blend in or be welcomed into the neurotypical community, is that this is what you believe other people are doing. But in reality, that's not what's happening at all. I think that's happened to me quite a lot, where I just assumed that this is what everybody else is doing, so that's what I would do. But reality, I was the only one doing it, and they were just saying that they were doing it, kind of thing. It's so.
Yes, absolutely. Oh yeah, I've had that experience a lot as well, where I'm like, especially not knowing what is a normal experience. I think especially like looking at both ADHD and autism in my own life, I'm like, yeah, but I don't know if this is normal. I think this is just a normal amount of this whatever XYZ symptom to have. But I'm now realizing that maybe not knowing if it's normal is in itself an indication that I don't have any clue of what other people experience.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, while you say that, there's a lot of discussions I have with parents and saying, I don't know if that is them being a teenager or if that's because of their neurodivergency. And it's like, well, you can't untangle the two anyway.
Yes.
Exactly. So you need to deal with what's happening in front of you, because yes, the teenager is going to grow up, but the neurodivergence isn't going anywhere. So you can't untangle the two anyway. And so when we're thinking about what supports to bring in, it's supporting what is in front of you right now, not what the possibility is in the future or what the possibility could be if we don't get it right. You know, it's allowing that both things are true.
Yeah. I think I get tangled up in that a lot, being like, oh my God, is this, is this ADHD, is this autism, is this anxiety, is this just being a human, like what is this? And I think my psychologist actually had a pretty good approach with this. He didn't pick up on the neurodivergency at all. And when I said to him, like, I think this is what's going on, he's like, maybe, like, yeah, go get an assessment from a psychiatrist, whatever. But was very much talking about like the functional impact of the problem. He's like, okay, like, what is the problem? What is in front of us? Like, how do we solve this problem? And that is a good approach to have. Like, I think it needs to be, that's kind of like a bottom up approach.
Yeah.
And the diagnosis is like a top down approach. And I think you need both. Like, if you just go around solving just every problem that's in front of you, you're just kind of like band-aiding things. And if you just focus on top down, like you've got all this awareness of the neurodivergency, but that doesn't necessarily trickle down to problem solving down here. So I really do think you need the understanding of the potential lenses you could see this through. So like the neurodivergency or just being a teenager or whatever it is, seeing that lens and changing out those lenses, and then also doing functional problem solving from the bottom end. And that's definitely like the advice I give people the most. In terms of also, especially with ADHD, it's like one solution is never going to work for you forever. And you need to embrace the pivot. I saw that somewhere an ADHD was talking about embracing the pivot when something stops working for you. And then you've just got to embrace the pivot, go with it, change directions, try a different strategy.
Yeah.
And that's also been, again, like a self-compassionate way to frame it, in that not beating yourself up because something stops working or because you think it's to do with something else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can hear in people's language if they've just had the top down, sorry. Their language shows when it's just the top down approach, because they've got this highfalutin language, but then they don't know how to support it. So, and then you've got the people that are doing all the things and are band-aiding it, but they haven't got the language around it. So yeah, I think the top down and bottom up kind of meets in the middle, and then you get to fully accept who you are and have the tools and allow tools to be something that you have in your life. That's another area of frustration, I guess, in a lot of the people that I see, is that they don't want to need to have the tools. Without the tools, then you can't do the thing, and you want to do the thing.
Exactly. And this leads into like these tools and stuff leads into a whole other discussion about like not wanting to need them or not suffering with the tools. And I think it's funny how like they say that a lot of people can grow out of ADHD. I'm a little bit skeptical of that as well, because what I really think happens is that people have the tools to deal with it and then just learn how to do it as an adult. And I think that happened the other way around for me, where I had the tools and then stopped having the tools. And I don't think that distress should be a criteria for having a neurodivergence, which is the deficit-based model that we work in, unfortunately. And that, people think that they might just like not have it anymore versus like leaning into it and appreciating who they are because of the tools. But it's also created an interesting thing where people accidentally create tools for themselves. So there was a tweet going around recently. One of the questions on, I think it's the AQ, or one of the autism screening measures, is like, do you have sensory issues with socks or something like that? It's like, no, I don't have problems with socks because I have a system. That's what they're asking.
Yeah, there needs to be the there needs to be that backup question. But no problem with socks because I don't wear them.
Exactly.
I wear them inside out. There's no steam.
Yes. So there's a lot of things like that where I'm like, no, I don't have an issue with that because I have a system.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, the system means that I do have an issue with it. I've just figured out how to get around it.
Yes.
And again, with the neurodivergence in families, I was talking to somebody else earlier this week as well about like adults who are undiagnosed neurodivergent making accommodations for their kids. So like they might cut the tags off their kids' clothes because they're like, oh, well, I don't like tags, so my kids might not like tags. And then so they never notice, because, which is great in a way, because it means you're creating a safe space for your kids or your family because you're trying to make the world a better place for them, which is great. But then not having the tools, like when you go out into like the real world, not having those tools and all of a sudden being like, why is everything so bright and loud and itchy? Like, I don't understand.
Yes. And that, I think what we do with Gilbert, because he and I are both neurodivergent, but we've got different things that agitate us, right?
Mm.
So while I'm fully accepting when he tells me something, hello, beautiful.
Hey, hello. Bubba.
When he tells me something, I believe him. Whereas previously it would have been perhaps, well, just deal with it, or you're imagining it, or it's all in your head. Mm. Heard that before. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is in my head, and my head makes everything else feel.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
So it's been interesting because I used to try and get to the issues before they arise. Mm. But then if I didn't do it, then he would burn out.
Mm.
So it needs to be, it became him asking me for help again, tie back into him actually asking me for help. And then because I was well aware of what needed to happen, it was a really quick solution rather than him, like me kind of preempting what could happen and then burning out about it and then not doing the stuff. So then he burns out to him asking for the help, me being more than happy to do whatever needs to be done because I was prepared for it. I was ready, set, go.
Yeah.
But there's no eye rolling or sighing or can't you just get over it kind of thing. It's we'll find scissors and then you can let go of the tag. He started to collect the tags, which is a bit of an issue, but anyway. He calls them newspapers. I'm like, sure.
Yeah, but that comes back to a healthy attachment as well. Like a child needs to feel safe in knowing that their needs are going to be met. And unless parents have, and just people in general, unless people have that knowledge and awareness of neurodivergence, like I was kind of shocked about how much I didn't know when I first started learning about this. And then I continue to be shocked about how other people don't know about things and the stereotypes that come along with it. And especially as an adult woman, like the stereotypes that come around all those things and the preconceived ideas that people have when they come to it. I think in general, like awareness, not just within the neurodivergent community, like it's great that we understand ourselves better and that is crucial and probably the most important thing. But unless the rest of the world kind of cottons on and understands a bit more about it, you are still going to have those responses of like, why can't you just try harder? Have you tried that? Have you tried trying harder? Just try harder. Oh my God. Thank you so much. I hadn't thought of that.
The only thing that I tried harder and I pooped. No. Effort. No, it doesn't come with the eyebrows. Oh, amazing. I think we could probably chat for a very long time.
We absolutely could.
But we are coming up to time. Do you have any lasting words that you would like to share?
Oh, goodness. I think there's a space where we can celebrate the strengths of neurodivergence and also acknowledge the challenges of it, and that suffering in any way and struggling in any way means that as a human, you are deserving of love and compassion, regardless of anything else. So if you keep coming back to that core tenet, that's going to give you a really good base to jump off.
Yeah. So to speak.
Jump off into the world of into loving the world. Yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And it's you're worthy because you exist. That's all that needs to be. Like, you don't need to have diagnosis, you don't need to have issues. Like, you're worthy of support and love and attention in the way that you want because you exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I guess the more you share about what it is going on in your head, then the more that you will find support. That's my person running around. And the community, right? And that's going to make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Compassion.
Yeah, and the compassion is the foundation. I hear a lot of people like, oh, I'll love myself when. No, there is no when. There is only now. That's all there is. There's only this moment that you can choose to be more gentle with yourself.
Yeah, that's it. You need that. What do they call that? Unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
Unconditional love. Does this happen to you where you're driving down the street and a sudden memory flash back and you go, oh, fuck, what the fuck was I doing?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah. And I get like a physical reaction to my memory and I'm like, I try and ignore it. I'm like, Joanne, it was okay. it's done. Like, you don't, you're not going to do it again. Or if you do it again, it's okay, because whatever, it needs to be done. But that visceral reaction to being awkward and making stupid decisions somewhere along the line, I think bringing in a little bit of compassion will save me some energy and effort.
Yeah. You're like, you can't hate yourself into loving yourself. Like, no. Being like ruminating on and being harsh on yourself is not going to prevent you from doing it in the future. Like, being kind to yourself and then checking back in with your values and being like, okay, if I can be kind to myself, I might actually have the tolerance, the distress tolerance, to be able to look at this in the face and be like, okay, I maybe don't like the way I acted in that situation. These are what my values are. This is what I want to do in the future. And the compassionate underlying like sense underneath that is what's going to help you actually face that and decide how you want to do it next time.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. I've appreciated your time and this conversation and all of the efforts that you are putting out into the world. Yay!
Thank you.
It's
so good. Speak to you. Yeah, so lovely to speak to you too. Thanks for having me on.